You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
First-time novelists don't usually expect their debut works to break sales records, but that's exactly what happened to Eden Lopucky, author of California, after Stephen Colbert encouraged viewers of his popular late-night talk show twice in recent weeks to pre-order it from an independent bookstore. It's a dystopian novel set in an unspecified time in the future that focuses on the struggle of a young married couple, Frida and Cal, to build a life together in the California wilderness as civilization as they know it crumbles around them. It debuted at number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list when it was released by Hachette earlier this month. I'm very pleased that it brings Eden Lopucky to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I understand that you'd been tipped off to watch the Colbert Show the night that he plugged your novel on national television for the first time. Were you alone, or did you have friends or family with you when he held up your book and encouraged his audience to pre-order it?
I had my husband there and my dog. My son was sleeping. I actually had to keep it a secret. I only heard about it shortly before it was going to happen, and they wanted it to be a surprise. So my mom and dad were watching by themselves at their homes. My husband was there kind of gripping my hand in disbelief that it was happening.
Well, the book deserves the attention, but it didn't hurt that you and Colbert share the same publisher, and there's a dispute with Amazon.
Yeah, so Sherman Alexie went on Colbert to talk about the dispute between Amazon and Hachette, and Colbert wanted to talk about the dispute because he's a Hachette author. He's published by Grand Central, and Sherman really wanted to talk about a debut novelist because it's so hard to get attention for a first book, and I'm an unknown writer, or I was, I guess, I feel it's difficult to benefit from the dispute because I know so many authors aren't benefiting. And at the same time, I feel incredibly grateful and lucky that it was me.
It's under the Little Brown imprint. Little Brown is one of the oldest publishing houses in America, but they're all it's owned by Hachette now?
Yes, it's one of their many. I mean, I'm not sure how many houses are under Hachette's imprint, to be honest. But Little Brown is one of them, and I love Little Brown.
Mr. Colbert, I'm calling him Mr., said that Amazon's refusal to allow pre-orders could be especially damaging to first-time novelists like you. How important are pre-orders for debut novelists? You don't expect them, do you? Nobody knows who you are.
I didn't really expect them, although I have to admit I was looking at my Amazon ranking every now and again before the book came out, and it was okay. And then as soon as the pre-order button disappeared, the ranking just plummeted, and I knew that, I think Sherman Alexie was the one on the show to say that Amazon had kind of made pre-ordering part of the publishing life of a book, and that it was really important and significant. And I just remember when the pre-order button disappeared, how powerless I felt. I mean, I worked so hard and for so long on that book, and then did all the right things and was hopefully as cooperative as I could be with my publicist, and then you essentially disappear if it's not there.
So luckily, there's Powell's.
There's Powell's. I mean, you can get the book at so many other places, and I myself don't shop at Amazon, but I know others do, and people who weren't aware of the dispute, then, I had friends text me saying, oh, I wanted to pre-order your book, and how come I can't get it on Amazon?
Although this experience has to be seen as the opposite of a dystopian experience.
It's true. It's been pretty surreal and lovely and, I'm still in shock. I can't believe it.
Had you wanted to write a dystopian novel from the start?
Well, when I started the book, that I wanted to write about a husband and wife at the end of the world. So that I set out to do that, although I was much more focused on my young couple, Frida and Cal, because that's kind of what I'm comfortable doing, is writing about people.
And they, when the book opens, have been living together in the wilderness off the grid for 2 years. Had life in Los Angeles gotten so difficult that living alone in the woods seemed like a better thing to be doing?
Yeah, well, when the book opens, as you said, they've been out in the middle of the woods for 2 years. And on the one hand, it has a kind of romantic quality of being just with your true love out in the woods. I mean, there is that element, although Frida refers to it as an eternal camping trip. And it's horrible, always outdoor showers and darkness and all that stuff. But when they leave LA has, it takes place in the 2050s. There's been a few huge earthquakes. Gas prices have risen so high that people really can't get anywhere. All the rich have fled the city into these enclosed communities called communities that are impossible to get into unless you have a lot of money. Services have basically left the city. There's no money anymore. So, and there's some family stuff that has happened with Frida. Her brother was a suicide bomber and has blown himself up at the Hollywood and Highland Mall. So there's a lot of family dysfunction that they're also fleeing. So it's sort of like they could rot in the city, or they could maybe start a new life and be together and start over in the woods.
Although you're not specific about what has caused all this trouble, would it be accurate to attribute the chaos to an environmental cause like global warming or extreme shortage of oil and gas?
Yeah, there's sort of a...
Or a denial of it by Congress?
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to make a realistic dystopia that didn't really feel very far off from our lives, so that in some way the reader would feel complicit in the making of this kind of experience for Frida and Cal. So I just took what is anxiety-producing for me and magnified it and just continued on the trajectory. So climate change, there's the earthquakes on the West Coast, there's been huge storms that devastate the Northeast and the Midwest, and hurricanes and things. There's also a lot of violence, like Frida's brother, in cities all over America, and then just the wealthier getting wealthier and wealthier, and privatizing things for them, which I see happening now and completely freak me out.
In fact, you're predicting it for 2050, which isn't all that far
off. It's not that far off.
As you said, Frida and Cal are extremely isolated during those 2 years, but they're much happier than we might expect. Do you see this novel as much as a love story as a dystopian story?
Yeah, for sure. I really wanted to write about marriage and the conflicts that occur between two people. I'm interested in ideas of intimacy and loss and secrets between people. And I really just wanted to investigate a couple who were in love and yet don't do the best thing for each other all the time. And I think the question at the end of the book is what now for this couple? Are they still a happy couple? But I was very much interested in the love between this young couple.
And how had they met? Her younger brother?
Yes.
Micah had been Cal's roommate?
Yeah, so Frida's brother, Micah, the one who's the suicide bomber, went to college with Cal, and they went to a college that I've named Plank College, which is a 2-year all-male college.
Is it based on any
It's based in part off Deep Springs College in California, at the foot of the Sierra Nevada. And that's a 2-year all-male college where it's super heady and they're reading tons of abstract theory, but they're also working the land. It's kind of like a back to land kind of college. So I read an article about that in The New Yorker by Dana Goodyear, and I just became kind of obsessed with the idea of this world. And then I went to Oberlin College. So it's a kind of a mashup of what I had read about Deep Springs, what I imagined for Deep Springs, and my own liberal arts college experience.
But most of the survivalists in the past have been very conservative politically. These are people who are not that way.
Yeah, they're not. They're definitely, these are survivalists who read Derrida. But in the book, I'm interested in, you know.
And they still love each other after that?
Or they read Barth, Pleasures of the Text.
One of the few people that Frida and Cal see occasionally in the forest is August, a peddler who visits on horseback, dragging a cart containing items for sale. Doesn't August tell Frida and Cal that he may be the last black man on earth? What's happened?
Well, it's kind of a joke on the horror novel or the horror movie trope of there's only one black guy and he always dies first. So I was kind of poking fun at that genre convention, and I was also in, because the book is so much about loss, I was interested in the notion of, you know, Frida and Cal have lost their families and their cities. Cal's from Cleveland, which has been decimated by a snowstorm, and Frida is from LA, which is in ruins. And I was interested in this idea of, what if you had lost a sort of larger community, and what if you were the only person who looked like you? And in California, I mean, the book there's a diverse cast of characters, I guess you could say, but August is the only black person among them.
And he won't tell Frida and Cal how many other people are living near them in the wilderness, although they have met the Millers. I don't want to give away too much.
Mm-mm,
because, but when Frida becomes pregnant, that starts off some serious problems. You would think that perpetuating the human race would be a positive thing here, but not necessarily a cause of trouble.
Yeah, so when the book opens, Frida thinks she's pregnant. Her period is late. And also when the book opens, you find out that their closest neighbors, the Millers, who had two children, have died under mysterious circumstances. And so the only person they see is August, who comes once a month with these goods that he's gotten from somewhere, and they don't know where he's gotten them from. And for a long time, there's been a tension before the book opens between Frida wanting to see other people and Cal wanting to keep her close and just the two of them for safety's sake. But the pregnancy creates a wedge between them because she feels like, okay, we're really alone out here. I mean, it's hard enough having a baby nowadays with lots of people around, but just the two of you, I mean, from a health perspective, you know, it's not like she's a practiced midwife or anything. So it forces them to have to try to find other people.
You tell the story in third person, alternating between Frida's and Cal's perspectives. Did you know from the start that you would structure the book that way?
I did. It was one of the few little gifts that kind of plopped into my lap. I started Frida's chapter one, obviously, and then I just knew it was going to go to Cal. My real first draft questions were how long before I switched from one to the other, but I really enjoyed being in both of their perspectives and kind of seeing how they felt about the world at different points, and it was kind of a fun plot gift, too, because you could know what one person knew and the other person didn't know and vice versa.
And you also know what they're thinking of each other.
Yeah, which is I felt I could rub my hands together and give
a little. But you didn't want to do it in first person.
I didn't. You know, I have written a lot in first person. I have a novella called If You're Not Yet Like Me that's written in first person. And I wrote a book before this one that never sold that was in first person. So by the time I wrote California, I was just over the first person. I was really delighted to be in third for a while. It's a nice
I understand
distance.
Colbert selected your book from a stack of debut novels from Hachette at the recommendation of Sherman Alexie. Had you met Sherman Alexie before?
I hadn't. He just called me on the phone and he was like, hey, it's Sherman. And I tried to play it cool as if it's a normal occurrence for Sherman Alexie to call me on my cell. I was like, hey, Sherman, how's it going, man? I didn't know him. I felt just so honored and also felt kind of more pure. So it wasn't as if he was just nudging elbows with another friend of his, you know.
Novelists tend to spend a lot of time alone writing. Many have told me that they think of themselves as introverts. Well, the New York Times called getting this sort of endorsement from Colbert the equivalent of winning the literary lottery. I wonder if there is a downside to all the extra attention. Are you comfortable with it?
Well, I'm the first to admit that I'm a showboat, so I'm very extroverted. I love teaching. That's why it's a nice antidote to writing, because I do love to be alone in writing. It is difficult to be, you know, I feel vulnerable as a first-time novelist suddenly having all this attention on me. And I'm so grateful to Colbert and Alexie. At the same time, I love talking about the book itself. But I'm just elated.
And now you're doing a favor to another writer? Do you know Stephen? Is it Stephen?
It's Stephen.
Stephen Ira Clark?
I don't know him. Just like Sherman Alexie, I think, was given some debuts, or I was given a few different books to choose from, and that one just popped out at me. I love the premise about a flavorist who works creating this sugar substitute sweetness number 9, and it's a book about eating and we are what we eat, and it's not only about that, it's about what you feed your family and protecting your family, and it's so funny.
And T.C. Boyle gives it a blurb. He says, after this, nothing will ever taste the same again.
I know. Every time I eat now, I'm like, do I want to put ketchup on my fries today? What is in here? It's sort of like I'm calling it Don DeLillo meets A.M. Holmes, but a little sweeter and goofier than that.
I'm assuming you're writing something new.
I am.
Are we past dystopia? We're going to survive after all?
We're past dystopia. It's a contemporary novel, but, you know, there's motherhood and marriage and friendship in there, so there's, like, personal apocalypses.
There are always the pressures of a second novel after you've had a success with the first one. Are you worried about that?
You know, I'm not.
Can you top this?
I don't want to think about that. But I already have written quite a bit of it, so I'm really, after all of this hullabaloo, I'm just excited to go back and write and think about sentences again. And this book has kind of, I feel actually liberated by how well California has done. I just feel like I can go write. You know, people might be interested.
I was surprised to note that no other book had been given the title.
I know. Me too.
When
actually.
You decided to call it California, did you think, I better do a search to find out if somebody else has taken the title?
Yeah, a bunch of guidebooks came up. Yeah. And, you know, California with a K, the movie. But I was shocked too because California is such. Everybody has an idea of California. You know, Californians themselves are created in part by the notion that other people have these ideas about them. So I'm surprised that there hasn't been another novel called California. But titles aren't copyrighted, so we might see more novels called California.
Well, you can write a book called War and Peace.
Oh, hey, that's a good idea.
Eden Lepucki, L-E-P-U-C-K-I, her novel California, published by Little Brown, which is a division of Hachette, and that is more significant than one might normally think. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much.